Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day from Movement. Whether your mom is into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, everything at Movement is up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale. A watch is a gift that celebrates all the time you spent with mom. And a Movement watch is even more than that. Movement uses industry-leading materials for their fresh, modern watch designs, from technically complex ceramics to vintage-inspired style, all for an incredible value your wrist and wallet will both love. And with one-size-fits-all convenience and fast, free shipping and returns, it's a stress-free shopping experience. Save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with Movement. Get up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
The test that they use is the Starbucks test.
Okay.
And the Starbucks test is this. Would you pull out your device and put it on your head in the middle of Starbucks? until such point, you do not have a consumer device.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast, your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. So let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice.
Hey, Andre, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing good, all things considered. Yeah, how are you doing with the COVID-19 madness that's happening right now?
You know, it's a big change, and it takes some adjustment to function normally. I think that this is going to go on for a while, so I see it more of a marathon run rather than a sprint, trying to pace myself for a long haul.
We're recording this on March 30th, so whatever numbers I say today, by the time this comes live, are going to be smaller compared to when it goes live. But yeah, I go on that Johns Hopkins site snapshot of the world, and you pick by country, and you can see it, and it's crazy. It's changing the way everybody works. You know, our office, and obviously most people listening to this are working remote, so you know, it's Zoom. Zoom is now a verb, right? You know, it's like, I'll Zoom you. Sure. You know, it's a whole new world, and it's not, to your point, ending anytime soon, no matter what politicians say. It's listen to the scientists, listen to the data, listen to the CDC for here in America for what's going on. And
there's no positive spin to this, you know?
No. There's a
change, definite cultural shift, as well as the shift in thinking, and then just adapting to our day-to-day lives. It's going to play with people with any anxieties, anxiety problems overall, OCD to general anxiety to germophobes, agoraphobics, you name it.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to mess with all of us.
So what are your current roles? And I say that plurally because you're kind of in a unique situation right now in terms of the game industry and software development.
I've run my company for 18 years.
Yeah.
And we have seen a lot of sudden changes and disruptions, technological.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, you know, we started out in mobile and mobile, old school mobile, flip phone.
Jamdat, Grayscale, right? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's 16 colors. You know, the frame rate was so bad that blur came for free. you would try to animate something and you get like this trail and blur, and it was awesome.
Right.
But then that was early 2000s, 2001 or 2.
Uh-huh.
And then around 2007, I believe, we had tremendous shift with the emergence of iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
That was really a game changer. over time, just the slope of the increase of ability of these devices to perform, turn them into something that compares to a computer.
Yeah.
And you can pretty much run PC games, being a little generous here, but you can run PC games on your mobile.
Yeah.
And then, so part of what we do, what I do still, is dwell in that space of mobile. Mm-hmm. Then we have an effort to pursue virtual reality. I think virtual reality is, as a device, or as a medium, is a meaningful medium. It may not have the slope of adoption that we wanted to see.
Right.
But I don't think that VR, AR, or XR cumulatively is going to go away. I think it's just a matter of having that 2007 moment that we had with iPhone, where somebody comes out with a device that looks amazingly sexy. The test that I use is the Starbucks test.
Okay.
And the Starbucks test is this. Would you pull out your device and put it on your head in the middle of Starbucks? until such point, you do not have a consumer device.
Okay.
But if you have to do it, otherwise you will just do it at home or somewhere you can do private, because it does not give you that sexiness that you want to flaunt it in public.
Right.
But the moment you come to Starbucks and you pull it out and put it on your head, and it looks sexy, that's the moment you're going to find it under your holiday tree.
No, that's a great metaphor. Because it's kind of like that sexy and or this is so compelling, I don't give a shit, and I'm going to put this on in a Starbucks because I need to experience this thing on the Quest or whatever, you know, whatever that thing is.
But it has to be something light that has AR in it and VR or XR experience. That's coming. I don't know when. I'm out of the betting game. I still see our effort in it as a meaningful effort. Lastly, I started a new gig of doing meditation in virtual reality, which is a broadcast, live feed, live streaming feed into virtual reality. That's a transformative, immersive experience. The user gets taken to the studio or a place of meditation.
Right. And it's in real time, so it's not canned, right? So it's like...
Yeah. It's this moment, in this moment, not the deferred later moment or previous moment. It is this moment.
Yeah.
And it solves for geography and solves for physiological, emotional abilities to attend a class or stuff. To me, that space is very interesting. Live streaming VR. I started that before COVID, and now with COVID, it makes even more sense to get out of the house, at least virtually.
So yeah, that company is Third Eye Center, right? Was it?
Yeah, Third Eye Center.
Right.
Live, was be alive.
Right.
But it's Third Eye Center. And that's what we do. We do live meditation in virtual reality.
And the other companies, you want to name those just for people listening to the reference?
My baby is Babaroga. And that's been my game dev company for 18 years.
Wow.
Back when I joined the game industry, I was walking through the hallways of Viacom New Media, and I didn't see anybody over 30. And And I would walk around and I would say, what happened to all the old people? do they take them out in the back and shoot them? That's like Logan's Run, you know, you suddenly reach that limit and you have to be taken out.
Right.
Well, it turns out that by 30, you burn out and you're done with the whole industry. And then you either leave and go to banking or something more meaningful or something else. I'll take it back.
But, easier in your lifestyle, yeah.
Better lifestyle, quality of life, they end up in contracting, which is where I started. From there, I built out a company just from the contracts we had, and that's pretty much how it's been run for all these years. Is that we just live on the contracts and worked in the contract that speak. Yeah.
So you're a mobile studio that's a hired gun that works with publishers and.
We work with publishers. We self-publish times, but we have done everything from rescue work boards to brand new, you know, full project development. So we've seen it all.
Back to starting. So I know the story, but how did you get started in this video game industry craziness?
I always liked games, but I never thought I would get a chance to make games. It was not an industry with an easy entry in early 90s. At least I didn't know how one enters such industry.
Yeah.
And I was more on the traditional path. What I thought would be traditional path of employment. Mm-hmm. And then in Chicago Reader, which was a local publication, I don't know if they're still in print.
I don't know.
In Chicago Reader, there was an ad too that I believe said, or I have internalized, that it said, play games, make money, no experience necessary. and I looked at that ad and I said, wow, that can't be real. I'll apply. It's going to make a good bar story, you know.
Right.
But, you know, and then I got a call. No way. I'm going to go and interview. Absolutely. I would love this. And then I showed up, and I remember I drove up to the suburb, Buffalo Grove.
Yep.
And I was wearing a suit with a tie. And I was like, you know, I don't know if I should go. And I parked in front of the entrance, and I was sitting in the car pondering if I should walk in with a suit jacket and a tie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I need to go and interview for a game job. Should I really be walking in a suit? So I took off my tie. I took off my jacket. I pulled out my shirt out of my pants, and I walked in. I'm like, well, let's see what happens. And then later on, I found out that if I showed up actually with a tie and a suit jacket, I would have never gotten a job. So it was a good call.
Good call, sitting in the car before the interview. Yeah.
Ponder on, you know, my look. And then I believe, John, you asked me, since you interviewed me, what's your favorite game? That was the first question. And I was like, wow, look at that. I was having a job interview that asked me about my favorite game. And we talked,
right.
And you walked me around the QA. And I was amazed because there was a bunch of kids with their feet on the desks playing games, what looked like playing games. The next thing is I got the job. I showed up, and then I found out that QA is one of the hardest jobs you can have in the game industry.
Yep.
It really is that job that tests your abilities to keep focus and stay on something that at times feels very tedious. And it's not just playing the game. Because if you play the game and there are no bugs, then the game is done and you don't get to play. But if it has issues, you have to describe them and produce them and solve them and present to whoever needs to see it.
Record video and all that kind of stuff, yeah, right.
So I spent 3 months in QA. I believe that somebody came into the QA room, accused us of slacking and not working. I was in my righteous early 20s, and I said, well, I never. And I walked over to HR and said, hey, you know what? I can actually program. And I believe with your help and help a few other people, I made my way out into programming branch, and the rest is history. That's where I kicked off.
So you did your 3 months of boot camp, because QA, especially back in the 90s, was just like, can you survive this gauntlet of playing this buggy licensed game with a short deadline, working many hours, trying to get this thing done? And it's like, do you have the stomach for this? Because it was tough.
I've been around for many years, and I still reflect to those 3 months. I can't believe it was just 3 months that I was in QA, but it seems
like 7 years.
Those 3 months, lifetime's worth.
Yeah, those were crazy times. It was a QA, software QA and hardware, because that was back a lot of times before even DirectX. So you had to have this suite of video cards to test and write the drivers to play the games, and if the hardware was quirky and the install base wasn't so hot, you just put it in the README and too bad, so sad, your weird little video card will not play this game because it's just too much work. So there was a hardware QA and then software QA, and that team was about 25 people with Viacom publishing all kinds of games, developed mostly.
Yeah, and it was a very talented crew. I mean, from QA to production staff, it was a really, really talented.
Yeah, point. Yeah. There were some hits, but sometimes media companies just don't have a stomach for the long view and not having enough hits in a row. So yeah, we shut down. So now, reflecting back, seeing all that you've learned between then and now, like what do you wish you had known when you had started?
There's a lot that changes with age and experience. What I wish I knew.
If you could tell that 20-something you know.
It's the resilience and persistence. I think that's a thing that I would think I could succeed in this industry is if I kept the resilience and persistence.
Yeah.
What else would I say? I would say don't take everything too seriously. A lot of effort was spent in things that are really not that memorable.
Yeah.
In terms of even getting caught in the politics of things, you know, just thought about that question a fair amount. And somebody said the older you get, the less advice. If you learned anything, the less advice you have to give. So there's really less I can advise back. Not because I don't want to, but just because I really don't think I can.
No, but that is good advice about don't take everything so seriously. Because, like, you know, in the heat of the moment, you know, Congo the game has to ship or the world is going to end. And, you know, 25 years later, who gives a shit, right? It was... one game of many games, and you know it's not worth killing yourself over. So yeah, be serious, be focused, be dedicated, but especially if you have the personality where you're so earnest that you don't let yourself get overwhelmed, and keep things in perspective. Like, will this, you know, will this matter a year from now? Will this matter 5 years from now?
I think, you know, one of the learning points, one of the when you walk in and you start programming and you're paid engineer making games for the first time.
Yeah.
To me, there was a lot of insecurity of, can I actually do this? Mm-hmm. And the story, again, I think you've heard the story, but the story I like to tell is I would go to the senior engineer. I would go to Fred Allen.
Yep.
And I would walk into his office and say, well, how do you do this? How do you do that? And I think I overstepped my line one too many times. And at one point, he turned to me and said, why don't you just handle it? And I, you know, it made me step back, jump out of my seat. And I thought to myself and said, yeah, I think he's right. I need to handle it. Right. And then I, you know, went back to work and just focused on the task and read the manual when required or needed. Mm-hmm. And started solving my own issues. Being able to embrace your problems or problems, your tasks, staying with it, and being resilient in those situations, taking it seriously, but not getting caught up on details that are out of your control again.
Right. Or, yeah, to your point, like, that you were thinking to yourself, is this right? Do I do this? Do I do that? And you were given that, like, hey, guy, figure it out. And you're like, all right. It gives you the confidence to know that, like, hey, he trusts me or he doesn't have time for me. So I just need to figure this out on my own. And I'm just going to do what I think is right and see where the chips fall.
I'm seeing it from the employer. So from the opposite side, I'm seeing it as an employer or somebody who manages people. Mm-hmm. When I do a hire and they can maintain their own tasks and solve their own problems, I welcome that very much so. That's what you want to see in a person who can come up and get tasks done without much.
No, that's cool. And that kind of rolls into my next question. Like, you know, what advice would you give someone looking to get their first job?
That ability to be self-sufficient. Know which questions to ask and which to research. Be able to embrace the tasks. My experience that the way I would like people when they come on is to do what they get hired to do and then spread out in any other task that they want to. So any other interest that they may have, explore, find what gives you meaning, but really handle the task at hand and do it well. And then the world is your oyster.
There's that story about, like, before you can ask someone a question, you have to ask the rubber duck, and it kind of forces you to think through the question. I just pulled up. It's like rubber duck debugging is a method of debugging code. The name is reference to the pragmatic programmer, which carries a rubber duck and debugs their code by forcing themselves to explain it line by line to a duck. Have you ever
That's
heard of
awesome.
This?
That is awesome.
Yeah. So it's like, before you go to someone, like, all right, explain it to the duck, the rubber duck sitting there by your computer, and then that'll click something in your head before you need to actually reach out. So it's called the rubber duck debugging. And it's a book called The Pragmatic Programmer. So what about somebody further in their career, like looking to advance as an engineer, or, I mean, you're a CTO. So, like, you know, what CTO and founder and owner. So, like, what advice would you give those people that are already in the industry?
Hey, hope you're enjoying the show. If you are, please go to patreon.com/gamedevadvice. We'd love to see if you can support the show and help new episodes keep coming out. That's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
It really comes down to where your interests are. If there are interests that you would like to pursue, that you don't treat it as a job, really as something that you want to wake up into and handle it. Otherwise, it becomes a chore. So
yeah,
curiosity, exploration, and finding a thread that's meaningful. Outside of that, I was never a person that enjoyed repetition. So repetitive work would really alienate me quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And this industry is, I can tell you, not repetitive. there's always something new. It may be a riff on an old song, but, you know, it's still a...
Right. Yeah, no, and that's the point too, is like when you're further in your career, you've experienced doing these different types of things in whatever your discipline is. So you should have a better sense of, like, that excites me, that, you know, I think about that when I'm trying to go to sleep at night. I'm passionate about doing that, but that other thing that's repetitive, dislike doing that. So I need to figure out how to do that first thing more, or vice versa. If you like more structure and not the randomness, maybe you're more into the repetitive and being better at a craft and doing something over and over. So
video game industry overall is moving very fast. It is one of those razor's edge industries.
Mm-hmm.
That they're always on the edge of innovation. So if you're talking about when we were all in console and, you know, phones emerged, looking at phones and saying, Billy, you can play games in this.
Right.
And then you had different steps in evolution of that. And now you're in virtual reality. So there are all of these steps and all of these new advances in the hardware and software that gets you to make something different or explore a different venue. So it's not repetitive in the sense that you're, you know, stamping things.
Yeah.
Building doorknobs. You're not. You're always evolving on some level and trying to stay relevant.
Yeah, and I think that's key too, is for longevity in the industry, you need to stay on top of what the latest tools are, whether you're an artist or programmer, designer, and figure out where the industry's going, and not just being kind of like, just keep doing the same thing and letting the world pass you by. You need to stay on top of that stuff and think of it as a craft and trying to figure out how to improve yourself, whatever you do, so that you're more valuable. So in terms of projects, what's been like one or two of your favorite games or projects you've worked on?
That's a hard one as well. so I'm going to answer it in this way.
Mm-hmm.
The project, the things that you get out of the license, and it may be an interesting license that you're working on. So
yeah.
Having worked with EA for multiple decades, you would see a fair amount of licenses, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, where the fun for me is in a particular setup of a team where the production process is innovative and enjoyable, and it can be just people coming together to execute a really well done game. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things are much more meaningful than the end product to me. Because the process of making was fun of doing it. That's great. So it could be something like My Sims that we worked on, where we created the content. Our relationship with the publisher was excellent. The development in the company was awesome. Mm-hmm. So, you know, content like that is really, because that's my day to day. That's what I like to see. That's what I like to do. I like to make.
And then you've worked in some licenses. Didn't you work on something with Judas Priest?
We made a game that we tried to... So there was this... the whole idea is that Judas Priest and Bob Halford really invented, and I know that these are them fighting words, but created heavy metal look and feel with all of the leather, right? And you go through this journey of heavy metal and Judas Priest, you end up with... Mad Max, or the last iteration of the movie. I know those are fighting words too. But anyway, you end up, so allow me this, at least these dots that I'm trying to connect.
Yeah.
So you look at Mad Max, and it was really like this Judas Priest, or at least heavy metal look too, post-apocalyptic. So right. We created a game that played off of Mad Max and Judas Priest, the whole portfolio, and then tied in a Guitar Hero or Tap-Tap mechanic on mobile. So mm-hmm. We tried to create this adventure that they're on that was very storytelling through Guitar Hero.
And you got to meet Rob and the band and stuff like that and do stuff like that?
Actually wrote lines for Rob to say, how cool is that? And then Rob went and improv, and all of the footage made it into the game. So that was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Then we went to, and I think we were a little ahead of our time, wanted to go and create a licensed version of Guitar Hero Tap Tap in virtual reality. This was, you know, maybe a year. HTC just released their hardware at that time. Mm-hmm. So we created this, you would use the controllers, the hand controllers, and you would whack the notes that were coming your way or cars coming your way.
And okay.
Standing on top of the bus, and you have these long things that you would beat them. Later, it was another company, the game called Saber Beats.
Yeah, I was going to say, it started to sound like Saber Beats. Yeah, right.
We were a little ahead, and we couldn't sell the our concept didn't stick.
But you were there, and Saber Beats, yeah, because Saber Beats is everywhere.
Well, right? Yeah. Saber Beats did its thing. They did excellent execution. I'm not trying to take anything away from them, but I knew that there was space for a music game in VR, and Saber Beats did its thing, you know.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. It validates that theory, right? Because of how well that is done. Yeah. So in terms of the industry, like what are you curious about right now? I mean, we talked a lot about AR, VR, XR.
Well, I think I am on that XR path. It's not at the moment. It's not glamorous, and people roll their eyes when you mention it. But mm-hmm. I think it's a path that I see long term. It's a long flight, but I see there's a huge potential, especially going back to where we started in the cultural shift that we have today.
Yeah.
Makes a lot more sense. I don't think that there has been a killer app, and I don't think the execution is still clunky in some ways, but I just because it's not there yet doesn't mean it doesn't hold a promise. So
mm-hmm. What about you know, threats or things in the industry that you're concerned about, whether it's from within the industry or, you know, external?
When we started, or at least when I started in this industry, it was a completely different space. We made games, we put them on the shelf. Mm-hmm. They were at Walmart, and they were at Kmart, and they were at Best Buy.
Babbage's.
Yeah, Babbage's, that's right. That made a lot of sense. Then we went through the phase of mobile where everything shifted. We went from what your console game would cost at $40 or $14 on the low end, We went to mobile that went from 14 very quickly to 10 to 5. And then we went to zero. And then we went to spending money at zero. So it was actually costing the user acquisition started growing. You would pay a lot of money hoping that you could convert somebody to spend money on your game. So you started giving it out for free.
Yeah.
Which completely devalued the game itself. Games slowly became, or some of the games slowly became just money pits without any game quality. And I think there has been some shift away from that, but still that it's hard to be in a conversation where it doesn't end up in a discussion about the cost of user acquisition and how do you recoup the money from free to play. And most of the games are still free to play in my world. That has been one of the fundamental shifts that I'm not enjoying. For the depth of games that we used to, or at least they perceived having, you know, your old Looking Glass games.
Yeah, it was an experience, and you paid the ticket and you got the ride, and it was all there. Right.
And 40 hours of gameplay or 80 hours of gameplay you would spend, it was different. It wasn't just a rehashed first level with lesser graphics. It was an experience too. And you feel at the end of the journey that you have journeyed. That's what I miss. And I fear that we are in this very impulsive, short attention gameplay cycle right now. And I hope that changes.
Yeah. And there's the, you know, these things like Apple Arcade, which I find interesting, right? Because it's like, you know, it's all you can eat and you pay that monthly amount, but then you're not being nickel and dimed with, you know, shaking the can to play the game. So what about funny or odd story from working in the industry? And I'm...
Dude, that comes with the cost of peeling scabs.
I mean, you think about the first place, Viacom, there was so many characters there and such a weird place and fun and exciting and frustrating all rolled into one. So yeah. You know, there's probably dozens of stories from that.
There are, and from my perspective, I started out as entry in the industry, and I'm seeing it as a veteran in the industry. And I think you mentioned in some other conversation that, you know, people our age, there's only like 5% still left in the industry, or some very small number of people who have spent all of their career in the games.
I'm like 1 or 2% of my age, so yeah, it's frightening.
So when you reflect on it and you see it from this vantage, and you look at those humor filled stories, suddenly come with a different from a different perspective, and it's like, oh, I see, you know, more to the story from my point, and then it becomes a little more cringy. But
hey, you worked with Judas Priest, and Rob got to see some of your lines, so that, you know, that's a good story.
And then we did a 3D printing of Rob's head. All in one day's work.
In a day's work, yeah. What game or games are you playing now that you're excited about?
Currently what I play are games for research. It has come down where we have to dissect either things for inspiration or competition, see how the mechanics is done by somebody else, innovate on that. So in my world, it has really become just about looking at things from the perspective of having to make them. Now,
is there anything I should have asked you about but didn't?
So my favorite interview question I give to potential candidates.
What is that?
Is if you were me, what would be the question? One question you would ask you. And my favorite answer that I got from this kid was, I would ask me, what's my favorite game that you guys made? And I said, okay, great question. So what's your favorite game that you made? And he says, I don't know, I didn't play any. Fantastic. Great question. You just figured yourself out. That's awesome.
Man, you're like, this guy did his homework. He's going to tell me about my Sims and why he loved the controls.
Don't peel everything from like, in 2002, you did this game. Really? I did? That's awesome. Thanks for reminding me.
Right. And you're like, oh man, and that's a good point too. It's like, there's no excuse, people. It's like, there's this thing called the interwebs. You can do a little bit of research, spend a little bit of time before you talk with a company. And so you can speak with some intelligence and ask that question back if you get the question asked. It's sometimes shocking when you see people that have no idea about what the company does. And you're like, do you know how easy it is now? We all have computers in our pockets, right? Like, and it reflects so poorly on yourself as a candidate if you can't speak to what the company does to some degree. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, Rain Man and recite everything back verbatim, but you have to have some idea. Especially if you're doing it on-site, that's just crazy.
Well, it's a heck of a competition to get into video game industry. And then there's mass application to all companies you can find. And, you know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of them. A lot of errors are made in that rush to apply where a candidate would use a form letter without proofing it, and then I would get, sir, I would like to apply to your for a position at Incredible Technologies.
And yes. Like,
you know, that's great. Wrong email.
Wrong, right. I've seen those too. I'm like, wow, that's great. Wrong company. Like, attention to detail, strike. Yeah. It is a curated personal approach. You don't, shotgun blast trying to get a job. And then wonder why nobody calls you when you email like 30 companies and have designer on your resume and you're applying for a programmer job or artist job. And it's like, you have to be smart. And there's a lot more companies in the industry now than, when we started, but at the same time, there's a hell of a lot more competition. So I think you have to be smart about it. You have to personalize stuff. You have to have experience for the things that are in the job description so that the person on the other end, like you or I or somebody else, can be like, yeah, I'm looking for A, B, and C, and they have A, B here on their experience and part of C. This is worth time to pursue versus just shotgun blast. I'm going to send some resumes.
Making sure that your applications are meaningful, that you're applying to companies where you want to apply, where you want to work, and then put effort into presenting yourself in the best light. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things, the attention to detail in application make a whole lot of a difference to me when these applications show up in the inbox.
Right, because it kind of speaks to your personality, right? Like if you're not paying attention to detail for this, then how sloppy is your code going to be? Or are you going to check in art files that don't follow our standards and there's textures all over the place? And you know what I mean? It just kind of speaks to how you do one thing is how you do everything. So you have to have that attention to detail to show that you're professional and not just scattershot. Okay. So where can people find you online? Like website, Twitter?
So Babaroga, babaroga.com. That's the home base.
Mm-hmm.
So I am Andrea at Babaroga.
Okay.
And then Third Eye Center is pretty much the same thing mm-hmm. on the website.
Yeah.
We have Third Eye Center at Third Eye Center VR on social media. So do please reach out.
You're based here in Chicago, and that, again, that's amazing. You've been doing this since 2002 on mobile, and especially people who are interested in VR, who are interested in meditation, who are, trying to deal with the craziness that's our world. This VR stuff that you're doing is pretty exciting. I went by and checked it out.
Meditation is a wonderful tool. It will not solve problems, but it provides you with a set of tools to use within yourself.
Yeah.
While giving yourself space to process the problems and solve them in a not reactive way, in not a way that is counterproductive. Creating that space is a wonderful thing, a wonderful work you can do on yourself to get there. So I discovered meditation a couple of years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it has made a whole lot of difference in my life. And I cannot you know, Third Day Center has been a work of passion for me. It's been something that I really believe in. So, so that's where Third Day is for me. Mm-hmm. And video games is really because it's fun. And I do it because I enjoy it.
And that's fair. And, you know, in terms of the meditation thing, it's like, it's not a cult. You're not going to shave your head, right? You know, there's all kinds of different ways to do it. And it's just a place to have a little bit of peace and just kind of collectively catch your breath. And people are like, you know, it's funny, like the people that I know that are the most antagonistic about the idea are also the ones that need it the most. They're the most stressed out, angry, raging people that I know, but they have no desire to do it. But I'm like, look at you're going nuts. It's like, it just doesn't cost you anything. Why would you not want to just try it for a little bit to see if it gives you a little bit of a break or a little bit of peace or lets you deal with processing stuff? And it just, it always blows me away that those people that push away from it the hardest are the ones that could benefit the most from it. And yeah, there's all kinds of ways you can do it. You know, what you're doing, I think, is exciting. There's tons of apps out there like Calm and Headspace and 10% Happier with.
So one of the things that I do when I get meditation guide is really try to help facilitate a conversation before the meditation and after. And similar to what 10% Happier does, I think there is a pushback against meditation because meditation is not understood as a tool.
Yeah.
There are many approaches to meditation. You can approach it from the spiritual end, or you can approach it from a pragmatic end. But the point of what is meditation and what does it do for me, those kind of questions, I think are not easily or not always answered. And I think providing those sort of answers of a meditation as a tool that creates the space and allows you to process feelings, process, not run away from things that are uncomfortable, but finding comfort in discomfort, understanding that your place in the flow of is why meditation is valuable, and it makes complete sense. And you know, it may be focusing on a mantra, or it could be focusing on your breath, or focusing on something, a point of focus that brings you present, aware, and able to find that space. It's a very simple notion, and it at times feels very hard to convey to people who are resistant. And you know, maybe it's not for them now, but in time, maybe they'll get to that space and figure it out on how useful it is. Meditation, you don't glorify a hammer. A hammer is a tool that allows you to nail things.
Right.
Meditation allows you to build that space. That's what it does. Mm-hmm. At least it does for me.
Yeah, I think the phrase I've heard too is there's the stimulant, like, you know, the input, and then there's a response, right? So, you know, being able to process and have a gap between those two, between going straight to hairline trigger and, you know, blowing a gasket, but being able to have that space in between the stimulus and then the response, something you can learn through meditation and not do it all the time, right? Nobody's perfect. Maybe the Dalai Lama is close to it, but whatever, at least just being able to have those gaps sometimes where you don't go straight from 0 to 140 miles an hour dealing with something in a way that you regret later, right? That somebody's pissed off at you for 48 hours or more, or something
and
worse.
Finding that, again, we keep referencing today's age, but I think it's relevant. The anxieties of being in U.S. on March 30th, you know, instead of self-medicating or finding some different ways of distraction, just being with it, understanding that this is that it is a difficult situation, that it is hard, that it's tragic, finding some ability to process it, that giving yourself calm to be able to sit with it. I think that's a much different approach than my previous approaches, which would have been to escape into some level of, you know, Netflix binging or something.
Right.
Or I remember
Candy Crush marathon or something. Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. So it allows you to actually process.
Not that, like Candy Crush, but yeah.
You don't have to be in the news cycle the whole time or in social media the whole time, but it allows you to sit there and just find some comfort in this very difficult situation.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of times too, people get freaked out about what's going on. So they look to self-medicate, they look to distract. They look for that cotton candy dopamine hit of whatever it is to distract them. But in the back of their minds, they always know that thing's there, right? And it's always there. And you're like, I'm just going to keep getting distracted because I got to deal with that. And it's always kind of lingering, just getting you more anxious, even though you're getting that kind of cotton candy dopamine hit from Netflix or the video game or the third bottle or third glass of scotch, whatever it is. Understanding that you're like, it's not going to go away. It's there. So you have to figure out how to lean into it and just kind of come to peace with it versus trying to distract yourself. And then it gets even to be a bigger boogeyman to deal with later, which adds more anxiety because you're like, I got to deal with that boogeyman later, but I'm going to keep playing this game now or watch season three of the Ozark or whatever the hell it is.
That's why I like the Dan Harris story of him being a live newscaster on ABC. Mm-hmm. And then having a complete breakdown, was on
live TV,
self-medicating, and then had a panic attack.
Yeah,
broadcast.
Yep.
And then that is what, without belaboring the point, that is what led to discovering meditation. First, mm-hmm. I heard that story, and I'm like, okay. And then I listened to Dan Harris for a while.
Yeah, so did I. And he has a lot of insight. And
that's right.
Interesting guy. And there's a great podcast and a great app. So it's a way that gets into it that is also a little bit more just about the science and a little bit more not clinical, but less, you know, bells and smells and gongs and things that might turn some people off.
You will come across, you will have pop culture meditation experts like Ram Dass, Jack Kornfield. And then you have the silent heroes like Jon Kabat-Zinn, the guy who started in the
MSRB, right? He started that. Yeah.
Jon Kabat-Zinn is amazing.
All right. So hopefully people have some ideas on how to deal with this of the COVID thing world here to try and help, whether it's COVID-19 or just life in general, right? Because this stuff is all very applicable a month ago, let alone now. So
all of our lives are filled with stress. Coping with stress is essential. This is additional layer that nobody asked for, but we process it and we do the best we can with what we have.
That's some great info. Thanks for sharing your ideas and perspectives on that.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, John, for having me on. This was really fun. I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, so did I. I think this was a really cool discussion, and hopefully everyone enjoys it and has some ideas for dealing with the situation. Everybody, stay safe.
Thank you. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. Go to the website at gamedevadvice.com and you can find the show notes along with show notes for all the other episodes. Please also check out the new Patreon page at patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Have a lot of options up there for how you can support the show. Again, that's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks again for listening and being part of the show. Take care. Bye-bye.